If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. How is it that life expectancy for many across the globe has nearly doubled in the past century? That's the question at the centre of the Extra Life project from Stephen Johnson, which includes a book and a new BBC Four series, presented alongside David Olushoga. In today's episode, you'll be hearing more from Stephen on the scientific breakthroughs and public health innovations that have eradicated killer diseases or developed life-saving treatments, and have given us all an average of 20,000 extra days to live. Putting the questions to Stephen was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
We are talking today about what you call arguably the biggest story in human history, which is how we doubled our life expectancy. And you've written a new book called Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer. And there's a television show too that's presented by yourself and David Olushoga and is airing on BBC4 and PBS as well at the moment. And looking at these sort of scientific breakthroughs and the history of public health, it feels particularly apt given the global situation at the moment. And how did this project start?
It's funny. This project has been in the works for more than four years now. And when I originally came up with the idea, which I knew it would be a book, and I was hopeful that we could put together a TV series to accompany it. I thought that it was an important story to tell because, in a sense, the progress that is measured in health and human lifespan is made up of these things that are so easy to forget because, in a sense, the progress is measured by events that don't happen, right? The childhood disease you don't get at the age of two, the car accident that is a non-event because you're wearing a seatbelt that somebody invented, you know, in the 1960s. And so we forget how much progress we've made. We forget how deadly life was just a few generations ago. And I thought, you know, these are important stories to tell because there's still progress to be made. And we should remind ourselves that we're capable of these remarkable achievements. And they're also great stories, right? They're really wonderful stories of people solving complicated mysteries and fighting the establishment and changing people's minds about complicated ideas. So I knew it was a rich kind of bounty of narrative potential, and it was an important story. And I thought 4 years ago that the timing would be interesting because it would be the 100-year anniversary of the ending of the Spanish flu, the Great Influenza, which pretty much wraps up around 1920. So I thought this book and show will come out around 2020 or so, and that'll be a 100-year mark. And that's the last point at which you really saw a sustained global decline in overall life expectancy, was during that period from the end of the war into the Great Influenza. And so I thought if it comes out in 2020, there'll be this perfect kind of historical symmetry to the timing. Turned out that 2020 had totally different significance. And all of a sudden, you know, we were in the middle of this pandemic, the worst since the Spanish flu. I had largely written the book by 2020, but the show we made entirely in the middle of the pandemic. David shot it in the UK, and I shot it in the US. And, you know, the UK was in terrible lockdown, particularly when David was doing his thing. So it was very difficult to do, but it gave us the opportunity to tell a story that is largely a history story, but to tell it, you know, in the context of right now. I mean, I've kind of come to think of this as a 200-year history of right now, is basically what this project is, because so many of the themes that we're dealing with in terms of public health, in terms of changing your behavior to keep yourself safe, in terms of data, are just the and of course, vaccines are really the central stories in the world right now.
Right. And you just mentioned there some of the groupings that you kind of explore these innovations through. Could you give our listeners a sense of how these innovations are grouped together, both in your book and in your TV show?
You know, I'd had this original idea at the very beginnings of the project that so the basic facts of it are that around 100 years ago, life expectancy around the world was about 35 to 40. We don't know exactly what it was. And today it's about 73. And so we basically doubled life expectancy. Now, just to explain something that's important to remember, a lot of that is from childhood mortality decreasing. So a lot of people used to die at 5 weeks or 5 months or 5 years. Throughout most of human history, 40% of all children would die before they reached adulthood. So childhood was the most dangerous part of your life, really, until you got very old. But people are also living longer at the other end. So an adult in 1850 who made it to adulthood, his or her life expectancy would be about 60. Now it's 85. So we have added both younger people are not dying nearly as much and older people are living longer. So all that is to say that my initial idea was maybe you could quantify the actual innovations and say if we got an extra 35 years of life, 6 years of that came from vaccines and 4 years of that came from antibiotics, and you could really like chart the impact of each innovation. And that just turned out to be impossible to do. You just can't run a simulation of the history of the world and figure out what would have happened had vaccines not been invented. But you can do it kind of on a level of order of magnitude. And that's what I tried to do is basically divide it up. The book has 8 chapters that try and talk about each of the kind of 8 most important breakthroughs. The show basically has 4, and we hope to make more of them because there's so much more to be said about it. But in the show, we look at vaccines, which is really the beginning of the story of improvements in human health. It's the smallpox vaccine and a technique that came before it, variolation, which we can talk about. The real medical breakthrough in terms of medical drugs, which is penicillin and antibiotics, which is a fascinating story. And then data, which is surprisingly underappreciated. We solved a lot of important problems without actually needing pills or vaccines or hospitals, just by looking at patterns of data and realizing what was causing people to get sick and changing things like cleaning the water supply, which didn't involve hospitals, it involved public health infrastructure. And then finally, in the series on TV, this isn't a chapter in the book, we look at behavior changes, which are so important. So things like washing your hands and wearing a mask during a pandemic. That was something we added in the COVID context, because it was so apparent in, you know, April of last year that was a major theme that we needed to explore.
Yes, there are so many touchstones there that I think audiences and readers will find absolutely fascinating. And not to skip us ahead too far, but something I thought was a really interesting factor is the highlighting beyond the scientific and medical advances is the innovation and effort to distribute, to collaborate on large scales, to, you know, treat and ultimately eradicate things that have been killing people for hundreds of years. That's just as impressive.
Yeah, a major theme of both the show and the book is that while science and medical advances are crucial, and it is certainly a project that celebrates the importance of science in society, science on its own is not enough. And you need to take the ideas that come out of science and apply them at scale for them to make a difference. And that involves a different set of talents, right? It involves people who are activists and evangelists for these ideas. It involves legal reformers in some cases. It involves people who are just influential, influencers, I suppose, we would say now. and they're an important part of the story too. And so, you know, the best example of this is, which I think is probably surprising to a lot of people, is pasteurization. So one of the things that I found fascinating doing the research for this project is just how deadly milk was in the middle of the 19th century in big cities like New York, where I live, in part just because there was no refrigeration. So milk would spoil. You could get tuberculosis from milk. It was a major problem. And in New York in the 1850s, 60% of all deaths were children. So it gives you some measure of how dangerous childhood was at that point, and milk was one of the big killers. So this is a case study in this idea that science is on its own not enough, which is that Louis Pasteur, pioneering chemist, comes up with the technique of pasteurization, which by heating milk, 130 degrees, it becomes safe. You kill off whatever bacteria and germs are in the milk. He comes up with that technique in 1865, but we don't have pasteurized milk on the shelves in American cities until 1915. It takes 50 years for this life-saving idea to make a difference. And that's because it wasn't just enough to come up with the idea. You had a whole amazing kind of protest movements fighting for pasteurized milk, and this department store magnate named Nathan Strauss, who owned the Macy's department store, who in the middle of his career decided to become the huge, advocate for pasteurized milk, funding all these campaigns to get people to drink it and convince the milk industry to start pasteurizing and for laws to pass and things like that. So it's almost like a movement closer to, the suffrage movement or the abolition of slavery or something like that. It's not just a bunch of scientists in lab coats.
Right. And you mentioned these kind of evangelists and the campaigns to get all of these innovations kind of into more of the mainstream. But I thought it was quite interesting, or very interesting, that concerns and even misinformation regarding some of these advances are really nothing new. And what sort of pushbacks have there been historically? What examples are there? You've already given one.
Well, the most telling one, because we're in the middle of it right now, is the anti-vax movement. So anti-vax movements are as old as vax. As soon as you had vaccination as a viable public health practice, there were people who were, vehemently opposed to it. And I think it's probably fair to say that the anti-vax movement in the 19th century was even bigger than it is in the 21st century. And I think that. Vaccines are close to a kind of a singular health intervention, and there's on some level an understandable negative response to it, because unlike almost all other health interventions, you're giving a vaccine to someone who is most of the time not sick, and often you're giving it to a child. And in the old days, when you were actually giving them some inert, attenuated version of the killer virus or a close cousin of the killer virus, the idea of taking a perfectly healthy person and injecting them with a virus that is somehow related to a deadly pathogen rubbed people the wrong way. I mean, it's different from my child is sick, give him some kind of medicine to make him better. It's like, my child is perfectly healthy, why are we doing this? And that has just always been this fundamental tension with vaccines. Now, today, actually, you know, when you look at particularly the mRNA vaccines, you know, it never made sense as an argument, because statistically it was clear it was better for your child's health and the long run for society's health to vaccinate. Today, the mRNA vaccine, you know, doesn't even have any version of the virus. It's just a little software instruction set to instruct your cells to make kind of a simulation of the spike protein. And so they're incredibly safe. And that's actually one of my favorite moments in the show, where I interviewed Fauci, Dr. Fauci, our public health hero over here. And I interviewed him on the day that the Moderna vaccine efficacy numbers came back and they were just off the charts. He was so excited. He was like bouncing when he came into the room to be interviewed. And in the show, he's quoted, he says, you know, if you had told me 20 years ago that we could make a vaccine without even having the virus, which is what they did basically in January and February of 2020. They hadn't even gotten hold of a virus yet, but they had the genome sequence of it. And so they could design a vaccine without having the virus in hand. He said, if you told me that 20 years ago, I would have said, you're insane, that's not possible. But here we are.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think that one of the arguments I make in the book is that if you look back in the 19th century, one of the single most important breakthroughs in terms of human health in the 20th century was the discovery that soil was alive, that soil wasn't just a bunch of ground up rocks, but that it had a kind of metabolism.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
They're remarkable leaps, and there are so many highlighted in your book and your program. But I thought something that would be great to talk about is the vein of inequality that runs across a lot of these innovations, and those who were not, you know, the disenfranchised or not powerful, and were exploited even to make these advances possible.
Yeah, it's a major theme. I think it's at its most powerful in the vaccines episode, which is both the story of tremendous triumph and also, you know, kind of the highs and the lows of medical progress. This technique that originally preceded vaccination, which is related to it, and was an important inspiration for it, is variolation. And variolation developed outside of the West. It was not the product of Enlightenment science. It was probably independently developed in China and Africa and India and places like that. And it came to the United States through the slave trade. And David Olushoga in the show tells this story about Cotton Mather, the influential New England preacher, who was also kind of an amateur scientist and also was part of the Salem witch trials. He had a complicated relationship to science and reason. He learned from one of the enslaved Africans that he owned, that this slave, one Smith, was immune to smallpox because he had been variolated, basically been deliberately exposed to a small amount of the virus. And Mather got very interested in that, and that was one of the reasons why variolation came to the United States through the slave trade. And similarly, about 100 years later, Thomas Jefferson, while he was president, he became a big advocate for vaccines, which was good. And was Jefferson, to his credit, had a lot of interest in science and new ideas. And so he actually conducted some of the very first drug trials, in a sense, for the smallpox vaccine while he was president. Like, he just did it in his spare time in Monticello. So on the one hand, the Jefferson story is, you know, it's a positive one. On the other hand, the first people that he put into his drug trial for the vaccines were his slaves. And that just kind of runs throughout the history, that we have, you know, this mix of visionary ideas that lead to human progress bound up in, you know, kind of pathways of exploitation that are very hard to shake.
Absolutely. Staying in the realm of disease, and you've written about cholera before, and cholera obviously features in this as a scourge of terrible disease. But the way you come at it is through the lens of data. And I wanted to ask about William Farr and John Snow. What can you say about that sort of groundbreaking work they were doing?
Yeah, I had written this book many, many years ago, The Ghost Map, about John Snow, who solved the mystery, and it was a true mystery of where, why people were getting sick from cholera. And it was a great killer in the 19th century, a terrible killer, I should say, probably, and particularly in big cities. And people at the time thought that cholera was in the air, that it was, this was known as the miasma theory of disease, and they thought it was effectively the result of the terrible smells in big cities like London and New York, which was a reasonable assumption to make because London was probably the smelliest city in the world at that point. It had grown at such incredible speed that, you know, it was the biggest city the world had ever seen, 2.5 million people, and no real waste removal system. And, you know, people had cesspools in their basements. We could get incredibly gross here if we want to describe this. And so it seemed logical. They're like, well, there's all this stink in the air. It must be bad for you. But in fact, it was related to the waste, but it was basically the drinking water was getting contaminated because there wasn't proper waste removal systems. And people would flush all their waste into the Thames, and then they would drink out of the Thames, and they would get cholera. Cholera is caused by a bacterium. And what's so fascinating about this story, and this was true for both Snow, who was a local doctor in Soho in London, and then Farr, who ran the kind of statistics of health in the city, and he would release these mortality reports. So he was the official statistician, basically, for England and Wales. And between the two of them, they were amassing amazing amounts of data. And Snow had come up with this idea that cholera was a waterborne disease, and he tried to find it by analyzing what he believed to be contaminated water. But in fact, he couldn't see this organism because the microscopes of the day were just not powerful enough. And so he had to see it indirectly through data. And he basically famously collected data around an outbreak in Soho that killed about 10% of the neighborhood in just a couple of weeks. It was a terrible outbreak. And he analyzed where people were getting their water, and he proved that a well in the middle of Soho had actually gotten contaminated, and that's why people were dying. And so that ultimately was enough to convince the authorities, and eventually William Farr, who actually was a longtime believer in the miasma theory, that cholera was in the water. And that led to the building of the London sewers, which is an amazing engineering achievement of the 19th century. And by 1866, there's kind of a final cholera outbreak in the East End of London, which Farr helps to kind of solve. Snow is dead by this point. And that's the last outbreak of cholera that London has experienced to this day. So it's an amazing achievement because they did it all without being able to actually see the pathogen. Cholera was not observed under a microscope until the 1870s, but they could do it by looking at the numbers.
Right. So is it fair to say then that those are kind of more direct things more directly responsible for that very low life expectancy? But there are other more indirect and less obvious causes that are explored. And one I just thought was so, I mean, it makes total sense when you read it, but I was so surprised to read about soil science and that kind of innovation and how much impact that can have.
Yeah, this is the stuff I love to write about, where you have an innovation in one field that there are a bunch of scientists or you know, creative people trying to solve a problem in one field and or come up with a new technology, whatever they're trying to do. And it ends up indirectly opening up new doors of possibility in seemingly unrelated fields. So just history is filled with these kinds of stories. And I think that one of the arguments I make in the book is that if you look back in the 19th century, one of the single most important breakthroughs in terms of human health in the 20th century was the discovery that soil was alive, that soil wasn't just a bunch of ground up rocks, but that it had a kind of metabolism that was filled with organisms, that live soil, when you can plant something in the soil, that's because the soil is teeming with you know, these little organisms that are doing the work, and the kind of the nitrogen cycle and all that stuff that got discovered. That ended up being crucial for two reasons. The first is pretty obvious. It led people to understand how fertilization works, which then, once they understood the chemistry of that, they could eventually, in the early 20th century, invent artificial fertilizer, which was an offshoot of the weapons development too, because, you know, this is the chemistry is very similar. And so that leads to a major increase in the productivity of croplands around the world. Once you had artificial fertilizer, you could grow just the land became much more productive. And that enabled us to feed a growing population. Our population went from 2 billion to about 8 billion today over the course of that century. And if we had not increased the fecundity of the land during that period, we would have mass starvation. So soil science was important there. The other side of it is that soil science was important in the development of penicillin and antibiotics, because, you know, penicillin is a mold, right? And these molds, starting with Fleming and then with other people, they began to realize that these molds had developed interesting antibacterial resistance just living in the earth, surrounded by, you know, to them, deadly microbes that were threatening their lives. And so the penicillin mold evolved this strategy of killing off bacteria. And so people began to think, well, listen, if this one penicillin mold could do it, maybe the earth is filled with other molds that might make even better drugs. And so during World War II, actually, they sent soldiers all around the world as they're racing to develop penicillin. They sent them off collecting soil. Like in the middle of the war, they would grab soil samples and take them back to the United States, and they would analyze them and see if they could find promising future antibiotics. And so you get two things. The reduction of famine in the 20th century is a huge lifesaver. And the invention of antibiotics is probably the single most important medical advance of the 20th century. And both of them have this common denominator of understanding the metabolism of soil that was developed in the 19th century.
Right. That's quite the double whammy there.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's funny about it, if you'd gone back to those soil scientists in 1850 and said, you're gonna play a major role in extending the human lifespan in the next century, they would have said, what are you talking about? I'm just studying these little organisms here. I don't know what you're
talking about. Right. Well, I mean, if they wouldn't have thought what they were doing, if we can perhaps look ahead, then I know we're obviously a history podcast, but you've written that this project, you've said it's not a victory lap, and there are significant health gaps still to be addressed. And where looking ahead, where are the next campaigns being fought? Where are the next turning points coming from, if you can say such a thing?
Well, there's a lot. It's going to be a very interesting few decades, I think. We've seen one. I mean, the mRNA platform is an incredible breakthrough, as we've kind of alluded, and there's a lot more to come from that. And that, you know, we could very well face more lethal and more contagious outbreaks. The world is an increasingly connected place. And so, you know, COVID was incredibly deadly, but, you know, the H1N1 virus that caused the great influenza was far deadlier and killed much younger people. And so knowing that we can produce a vaccine that quickly is an enormous advance for us, and it may enable other kinds of treatments as well. Immunotherapy in battling cancer is an amazing new breakthrough. And it's similar to vaccines in the sense that you're solving the problem of cancer by not through some outward attack of radiation or chemotherapy, but by training the immune system to fight the cancer itself, which your immune system does all the time. It's constantly combating rogue, runaway cancer cells. it just gets tricked by some cancer cells into ignoring them. And so this is a kind of, immunotherapy is a kind of counter trick where you make those cancer cells visible again to the immune system. And then your immune system can do it on its own. So it's a much more robust way of solving it. And then, I mean, the only other thing I'd mention, there's much more to say, is we're just now beginning to think about what machine learning is going to be able to do in terms of developing new compounds, you know, just in an afternoon running through, you know, a million different molecular combinations to maybe produce a new antibiotic or some new treatment for Alzheimer's. And there's just an ability to explore combinations at tremendous scale that we've never had before. And that's the kind of problem solving and kind of possibility space exploring that computers do incredibly well now. And so I think we're going to see some major returns from that kind of investment.
Well, your book and this program does give such fascinating historical context to so many of these conversations. And I do encourage all of our listeners to check out the program. It's Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer. And Stephen's book is of the same title, published by Riverhead Books, and it's out now. And Stephen, thank you so much for your time in talking to us about this today.
I always enjoy coming on the show. Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Johnson. Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer, continues in the UK on BBC Four at 10 p.m. the 1st of June. The episodes released so far are available on BBC iPlayer, and it's also streaming in the US on PBS. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on the Golden Age of Piracy.